Well, we've already been confronted with a couple of problems for the application of the proper distinction between law and gospel. It was the morning after when a friendly student, it's not always a tautology, seeing the pottering professor potter on, said, "What were you looking for in the library last night?" And I said, "I was looking for a piece of law and gospel in Luther." And then he gave me, you know, one of those sympathetic, indulgent, understanding smiles. Oh, boy's losing his grip. But what lay behind that understanding smile was a profound theological insight. For to be looking for a piece of law and gospel in Luther is like looking for hay in a haystack. You just can't get away from it. No matter where you start, you're in for it. Just as there's no dodging the distinction between law and gospel in Luther, there's no dodging the distinction. For this distinction means to be at the receiving end of what God dishes out. There's no dodging it. The various ways of dodging it are to muddle them together or throw one of them away. Would you give those out, please, if you don't believe what I'm saying, then. And there's a 1542 to 1543 winter a table talk of Luther, in which he looks back and tells of how things came clear for him. You all know the time he says that in connection with the word righteousness, justitia. And he says that here too. And getting the hang of the distinction between law and gospel is just another way of saying the doctrine of justification. The end of that quotation has the statement that the law is one thing and the gospel another. They are in mutually exclusive relationship with each other. That difference does not derive from who is giving it out. It isn't as though man's wisdom carries you so far and then God gives you a boost to get the rest of the way. That is running a single track in which the gospel gets to be the completion of the law. It's running an unbroken progressive line. both law and gospel come from God. Same God, there's only one. And that overcomes then playing law and gospel games by way of Old Testament law, New Testament gospel. Or extremely in the Marcionite form, nasty God in the Old Testament, he gets much nicer in the new one. Yeah, it's the same old God all the way through. So it's not a difference of from whom it comes, nor is it a difference for whom it is targeted. The target is you. And not just a piece of you. That's another way of getting it wrong. The law takes care of me outsides, but the gospel that gets at me insides. And that's what's really important. That's the way of thinking that comes to expression when people go around saying that they're going to save souls. They don't save anybody. It's only the Lord who does that. And when he saves the whole lot. Not just the upper good bit, soul or internal region. There is no dodging by playing target adjustment games with God. He's got you in his sights. Nor is it only man. Man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as make the angels weep. Man who supposes that if there is a God, he must be surely there for me. He's there for the whole show. The range of law and gospel are the whole show. To push that all the way through would bring us into the doctrine of the two kingdoms. So the difference is not in who's doing it, or who is getting done to. The difference is in the job that's being done. And for the two different jobs, there are two different tools, means, instruments. And the Lord strikes with his words. If he hadn't spoken, we would be left making up our own gods as best we could manage to do that. That God has spoken is not yet good news. what he says. And he says two things. And both are his, and both are true. And since they are his words, they carry and deliver what they say. He has not left us in our attempts to replace him or subordinate him to some need or purpose or program that we set up at point number one. What comes at point number two is not God. If you've got anything going anterior to God, then don't fool yourself or anybody else that you're talking about God. And he tells how it is with us when we would take over, replace him, get rid of him. Sin, attempted murder of God, and it isn't then God that gets killed. Of his law strike all the way through. So that there isn't anything left of what we have tried to put in his place. And since that's you, it's you. That's to be killed. Now, there is no way of defending such a God. That is the shattering word in the bondage of the will, which drives through to the point of recognizing that God is unjust, that he is unfair, that we are born damnable, and we get damned. And nobody ever asked us whether we wanted in. That drives to the point that Walther, running with Luther, does The only thing you can do with a God like that is hate him. There is no possibility of defending such a God. There is no defense for him. And there is no defense against him. But only when we have been struck through to that point are we delivered out of our attempts to defend God, or as Milton says, to justify the ways of God to men. For a God whom we can defend is one who derives his credentials then from our capacity to defend him, for us to be able to show that God really is, after all, just. Not until then we are utterly defenseless before God. We are not only rid of our attempts to give him his credentials, according to which then he would be obliged to run the business of being God. But we are defenseless before God. And Luther calls that the mathematical point. That is a point which has no dimension. Now, how do you do the transition? How are we going to get over into gospel? Classic ways of doing that are Luther's three ladders: reason, feelings, and ethics. They are one track, one word of God, ways of saying things, where one step is where one step has as its necessary consequence the next step. And the three ladders, you can run that by logical necessity, by emotional necessity, or by ethical necessity. And when you use the ladders to do the transition from law to gospel, you are no longer two track, but one track, one word of God, God. And if you are laying on God something that is necessarily so, then you're not talking about God. Whether the necessity be run along the line of reason or emotion or
a morality. All of those lines of talk which issue in a one line of talk of salvation. If you're running the doctrine of justification here, then it's a transformative or sanative doctrine which emerges, and you're into that progressive fractioned more and more, and only the whole lot at the end. There is no transition. We can say nothing to get us from law to gospel. The classic presentation is in Romans, where the law lays in heavy, unrelentingly. There's nothing left of you that can stand before God. And the apostle has indicated that all makes very good sense. The justitia of the law is rationally compulsive. You get what you deserve. When the law has done its job, then every mouth is stopped. There's nothing more you can say to God. The law strikes you dumb. And so long as your mouth north at God, the law hadn't yet brought you to that point. That is the job that the law, that God, with the instrumentality of his law, does on you. All our mouths are stopped. But the apostle goes on talking. But he signals it with that turning point, the hinge on which the whole epistle turns, that the fulcrum, which he rings in with the nunide, but now, contrary to all of that, there is a God who justifies the ungodly. Not only those who are just messing up, but those who are hateful to God. Echthroi. He was on the cross for them. Their sins are forgiven. They are before God with all that Christ is worth. The good news is that what goes for him goes for you. I am crucified with Christ. His death for sin, my death for sin. Crucified. The big death of forsakenness of God. He was there with me. And he came through and brings me through. I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the faith which I now live, I live by faith in the Son. And the life which I now live, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. And that doesn't make any sense at all. People who run the law line of thinking and say it is unjust for God to damn me, then it is even more vastly unjust for him to forgive me because somebody took it in my place. That is why many people don't like the vicarious atonement. It is so blatantly unjust that another takes it in your place. That's not justice. And that God should be like that. There is no reason for. There is no rational, emotional, nor moral necessity for God to be like that. And therefore, the Nenide just proclaims such a one. And the words proclaiming carry and bestow what they say, for they are alive with the life-giving Spirit who brings what was dead to be alive by the enlivening gifts delivered by the Word. You recall how in 1 Corinthians, when the apostle has really a heavy one to deliver, he says, now, pay attention. This is big deal, and it's not something that I thought up last night. He uses the words of the rabbinic words of the transmission of a tradition, paralambano, paradidomi. What I received, that is what I handed on. And where it comes from is from the Lord. So the apostle is just the bounce-off delivery point for the words from the Lord. so none of my two bits were thrown in. Garbage in, garbage out. Law. But forgiveness of sins, body and blood of Christ, received, handed on. And that is a confidence which has its location then, not a bit of it in you, but from the Lord.